Welcome back to the Ridley Institute podcast. I'm Sam Forniker, your host, and I'm joined today by Esther Lightcap Meek. Esther is professor of philosophy emeritus at Geneva College, senior scholar at the Seattle School for Theology and Psychology, as well as a scholar at the Fujimura Institute. She's generously accepted my invitation to chat on her most recent book, Doorway to Artistry, Attuning Your Philosophy to Enhance Your Creativity, which was published just last year, that is 2023, with Cascade Books. This is a book at once of artistry and creativity, and it's a deeply philosophical reflection on how we live and encounter the world around us. Just for listeners, it's theologically charged, but it's not a book of theology. It's extremely beneficial from the standpoint of Christian discipleship, but it's not a book about discipleship, and it's charged with artistic reflection, but it's not just a book for people who perceive themselves as artists. So we all of us have a lot to learn in this conversation from Esther. Esther, thanks so much for joining me. A very, very warm welcome to you.
Oh, thank you for having me. And that was a wonderful, so what you just said was great. I like that.
Well,
so
thank you. Throw it on a blurb sometime in the future. Esther, could you, we've corresponded over email before this conversation, so you'll know this. My wife and I, we go out on a weekly breakfast date, and I have been walking around downtown Charleston holding a copy of Doorway to Artistry with a pencil and in one hand, you know, and my wife in the other hand, as we've walked to a place to get breakfast and to read this together. Sometimes she hates the things that we read together because I'm inflicting them on her. That has not at all been the experience with this book. This has been a really personally enjoyable book, interpersonally enjoyable book in a way that others haven't.
That's great.
So maybe just starting with an overarching question, as I've tried to say, it's a unique book. It takes this approach to knowing, epistemology, and it applies it to the act of making of artwork, and that's a really unique combination because you can find a number of books on artisanship or on philosophy or epistemology, but you don't often find one that so elegantly and winsomely inducts you into both worlds at once. So I'm just wondering, can you share some, you know, with us a little bit about your background, a bit of your story, what makes you tick, and how did a book like this come to be?
Okay, you just raised at least two questions. So I'll start with the first one, and that is, I, over the years, in my own quest to figure some things out philosophically, came upon and have developed an approach to knowing that weds it with the artistic act. Mm. And so lots of people in art tend to divorce themselves from things related to knowing, because they think that knowing, stifles artistry. Hmm. But so that says to me that folks in artistry would be better at what they do if they fixed their epistemology. What I'm trying to do. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book. Yeah. So because, you know, there's just a payoff for that. So now, how did I get into all that? So that's the second question. I have to say, I seem to have been on a quest for the philosophical long before I figured out what it was. Mm. And I grew up in a Bible-believing, serving denomination. My family to this day are all generally on the platform, either at the keyboard or behind the pulpit. And but around age 13, I found myself with these embarrassing questions. One was, how do I know that God exists? I mean, I knew lots about my Bible, but you know, there seemed to be like begged questions. And so that was one of the questions. But another one was, and this was even more embarrassing, how do I know that anything exists outside my mind? I thought it was strange, but I had no proof. And I had this sense, this arrogant presumption, I think now, that the only thing in life I was certain of was the stuff in my head. Mm. And precisely because I had certain stuff in my head, it blocked me from the world. Mm. That to me was obvious, and nobody ever taught me that. And what it is Descartes, which is, you know, he's the father of modernity, really, the modern philosophy. That's the Cartesian picture of how we are opposed to the world, right? And so I just inhaled that. Mm-hmm. Nobody, you know, I didn't hear it in a sermon or at school or that it was a, where it came from. I don't know. But then in high school, I read some Francis Schaeffer. Hmm. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
And Holly, you're kind of young. I mean, I'm more the age that was reading Francis.
I read Schaeffer in college.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Well, I found that my questions were not sin. They were philosophical. Hmm. And that responses to them had shaped whole cultural epochs across the disciplines. That fired my imagination for interdisciplinary studies. But then it was some years before I ever found out that you could actually study philosophy. Hmm. And the minute I did, well, 12 hours, it was a 12-hour life change. I changed my major and I changed my college to go study with this guy whose reputation I heard of who was teaching philosophy. And I felt, I was sure I was not smart enough, but I felt morally obligated because these were the most important questions. So that was, what was I, 20? Haven't looked back since. I've been living that out.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way.
That's wonderful. And it comes through in the book, I think.
Good.
could you, Esther, could you just pull the camera right back for us and explain, before we kind of dive into some of the ideas, because I think there's a risk in, it's such a rich book that we could start talking about things like the real and so on, some of these terms, which obviously you're very sensitive to those being, you know, specialist terms and so on. Can you pull the camera back for us and kind of give us a very general overview of what you're doing, what you're out to say in Doorway to Artistry? Like, what's the big picture listeners might need to keep in mind as we dive into some of these questions?
Well, maybe the way to go is to tell a little bit more of my story.
Yeah, please.
Is to say, you know, when I found that you could study philosophy, I still had these questions. And, you know, just because you take philosophy courses, they don't necessarily address your particular questions. So I plowed through to a PhD and in a way still had the questions. Hmm. And in particular, the question about reality. Hmm. So you can kind of see my whole journey as a quest for the real or for reality. Hmm. And I felt that I was cut off. And what's more, my weird 13-year-old questions, I came to see that everybody in the modern West has some version of them because that's what it is to be modernist.
Hmm.
And so I will never run out of a job. So in other words, my goofiness from my childhood turned into my calling. And I really do feel that stewarding what I have found and sharing with others, I actually call it philosophical therapy.
Mm.
And so the thing I say about philosophy is, you know, these fundamental questions like who the heck am I? What does it mean to exist? How do we know whatever it is we know? What is reality? What ought I to do? Throw God in there in any category, right? As a philosophical matter too. I mean, the most real and the one to be known and da, 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 you know, the one to be obeyed, you know, all of that. He's all the way through. But the way I've developed it is to say folks in modernity, and I mean 1600s to the present and only growing more strident, have inhaled, like I did, some implicit, a skewed implicit outlook or mindset that is toxic. And it's poisoning the way people do knowing and the way they see reality. And this is a philosophical matter. And because it's implicit, it's more like you wear your philosophy, whether you know it or not. And add to that, modernity is philosophically anti-philosophical, which is fiction. But right. None of us is equipped to identify what's the philosophical tenor of this thing. So that's why I'm always starting at the beginning, just trying to say to people, look, you there's one thing you need to be philosophical, and that's to have been born. You know, it's like to be human is to be, you know, to have this philosophical birthright. And you can't not live out responses to those fundamental philosophical questions. And then if you've inhaled something skewed, you can be living something out that doesn't even go with who you are as a human person, and you can be in a snit, you know, just like all tangled up. And one of the, I think it, that adversely plays out in every discipline, and so books on artistry. Now, along the way, a key breakthrough for me was finding the work of this guy named Michael Polanyi. And you can say Polanyi, you can say Polanyi, you can say Polanyi. What you can't say is Polanyi. It's not that Russian inlet in Hunt for Red October. But what he was, he was a Hungarian premier scientist turned philosopher. He died in 1976. And you know, as he, after this brilliant career, you know, of discoveries and Nobel Prize winners from his lab and all of this, he just felt the need, especially in the face of the pressure in the 1930s for socialized science, kind of coming from Russia. He felt the need to think things through philosophically, and in a way, he kind of stepped away from science to save science. So he would have said, if knowledge is explicit information, which is what our kind of inhaled paradigm is, no scientific discovery could ever happen. But it does. So fix your epistemology. So then he made these proposals, and he wasn't a trained guild philosopher, but scientific discovery was his job. That was his job. And so the question is, how do you come to know in the first place? It's not about collecting information, and collecting information isn't the key to get you to this beyond that you can't put into words. So you need a revised epistemology. Well, when I read that, it put things together for me. For one thing, to read Michael Polanyi is to say, you know what? This is how I know. And then it is, you know what? This is how my Christian faith works too. And so he really... his epistemology, and there's many, many sides to the public intellectual that Michael Polanyi was, and I just know a little bit of his work. So I don't think of myself as a proper Polanyian, like my Polanyi Society colleagues, but I have gone to the bank on what he says about knowing. And the other thing that he did for me, which I really needed as a human being, is... I really grew to feel that my calling and my obligation, actually everybody's, but I keep it to myself, you know, is to, you know, I'm not done my philosophizing until I make it accessible to everybody, which is a whole lot of extra work. So I left the ivory tower, and Polanyi helped me to do that, because what he said about knowing also worked in the kitchen. Or the garden, or business, or counseling, or, you know, it works. This is the way knowing works everywhere. That's why I'm you know, trying to trot out a series of books, taking my proposals into these different areas. And the next one just might be business.
Oh, interesting. Oh, well, that's a whole other conversation that we might have to return
to. Well, we might have it in about 3 years.
Interesting.
Does that kind of give you a little bit more? So that's, then you get to Doorway to Artistry, and what I'm doing there is saying, look, this Polanyian approach to knowing just is the creative act. And that's happening in the workshop chapter. But then I guess I do have to say a little bit more, and that is, he's helping me with knowing. And the thing that I wrote about in my dissertation was that Polanyi's, and I wrote it on Polanyi's kind of offhand claim that you can know you made contact with reality. Well, remember, I'm the baby skeptic, right? And here's this guy, the only guy in the world, practically, that I had read that was offering hope of contact with reality. And here's what he said. You have an unspecifiable sense of the possibility of future manifestations you cannot name, but you have this hunch that they're there. And so when you do listen to people who have made a breakthrough, they're not talking about confirmation. They're talking about possibilities. So that was like water on my shriveled up soul. And that's what I wrote my dissertation on. But it took me some decades to come to trust it. So I finally now am an exuberant realist splashing about in reality, but it's taken me most of my life to believe my dissertation on his work. And then also the other piece was in 2014, I stumbled on the work of D.C. Schindler. Do you know his
work? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've actually had him on the podcast before.
Well, yeah. I'm a fangirl. And now I'm proud to have him as my friend. But I found his essay called Surprised by Truth. And I fell out of my chair because it so went with all that I had formulated as I've groped forward, especially with respect to the real. So I think it's another problem with modernity that somehow in my church upbringing, I never was taught classical Christian metaphysics, nor in my graduate philosophical training. I did not know until I started to read his work. So then Schindler gives, you know, I've just kind of signed on for a novitiate to try to understand what he's saying. And so in Doorway to Artistry, I'm just picking up on David Schindler cool stuff about beauty and all of that. And I'm going to the ordinary with it. You know, I'm doing my best to make it for all of us in the streets.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really wonderful book. And I do, I love D.C. Schindler as well. I've been so appreciative for years of his work and of yours. So it's fun to get to have you both on. And just to complete the trifecta, I've got R.J. Snell coming on later. Let's put that off. And just to return, so can I return to something you said, Esther? You described that idea of philosophical therapy. I love that, right? This kind of like a journey from one way of being in this world to another way, like from the modernist default to this whole different way of being that you describe as festal or feast-like communion with the real. Now, I know that this is sort of to jump into the heart of the book, but first, I do want to ask about those kind of modernist presumptions that you talked about, because those are really important, and I'm not sure how many of us see those things. What do you think those reigning modernist assumptions or presumptions are from which we need that philosophical therapy?
Well, because I'm interested in doing philosophy in the streets, I'm more interested in what my neighbor thinks than what modernist philosophers think. Yeah. And as you know, whatever the philosopher actually wrote, that's no guarantee that that's how it plays out in the street. You know, I mean, the mistakes seem almost as powerful as the truth. So that's why, in a way, I could figure out what was in the brain of everybody else because I saw what was in my own, And you know, I just kind of pay attention. I've taught you know, humanities all these years and stuff like that. And you think about Zeitgeist and all of that. And quite widely, it is held that we live in the information age. Hmm. Yeah, well, so the paradigm of knowing that we inhale as part of modernity is that that knowledge is information. It's explicit focal sentences that we amass until we have a comprehensive collection of information, and that's exhaustive truth. Hmm. And what Polanyi was saying is, you know, that focal part, that explicit focal part, that's what actually blinds you to the real. Hmm. So just think how much more we could have discovered, yeah. You know, if we had been doing our epistemology right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with science experiments. The problem is and there's nothing wrong with information, but the problem is making information the philosophical paradigm. So the problem is philosophical. It's lived, as you say. So that's why we don't even see that we're doing it.
Hmm.
And we don't even see that it doesn't go with who we are. That we actually are doing something else. It's just that when we self-describe, we think we're collecting information. And that's all we're permitted to think. Huh. That makes sense?
It does, yeah. It's a little bit beyond cognitive dissonance, actually. It's sort of existential dissonance, isn't it?
This cuts you off from reality. And I think that's one reason anxiety is rampant.
Mm.
Because we are, and David says this too, in the beginning of Love and the Postmodern Predicament, is, you know, we have this disconnect from reality, and our selfhood is dissolving in tandem. Yeah. So of course there's anxiety.
Yeah. Can you talk about a little bit more about how that anxiety might relate to this this problem of kind of focal I'm not even sure quite how to articulate the question, but what you were saying earlier about Polanyi saying, you know, you need this revised metaphysic because of the what was the term? Focal
explicit information.
There,
as opposed to subsidiary, indwelt skill and savvy.
can you introduce that distinction a little bit for us?
And, sure, and I'd be happy to. I like to talk about sports. Not because I watch them, not because I play them. But I love Pittsburgh, so I'm a, you know, a Steelers fan and a Pirates fan. and so I would say that focal information would be, and right now we've got issues with our quarterback, but it used to be Ben Roethlisberger, who was amazing. So oh, yeah. I still think of Ben. Focal information would be Ben standing on the 50-yard line holding the playbook or, you know, memorizing it and voicing it. But that's not what we pay our quarterback to do. and Ben was an artist. So what he did was he wore the playbook.
Hmm.
And then if you ever want to see, and this is the term from Polanyi, and I can say more about it, subsidiary focal integration, just every Sunday, watch a football game. Because every time the play starts, that quarterback has at his creative, subsidiary, artful scrabbling, all his guys, I don't know the proper word, and then all their guys, and then the end zone. Right. And it yeah. is just unbelievable to me. It was just unbelievable what Ben could do. I'm a fan of Kenny Pickett, too, because I've also rooted for Pitt. So but his day is coming. but to see that artistry, that is the unfolding of knowing from relying on almost like wearing the subsidiaries to open up future possibilities.
Yeah.
And you see, if you had focal information, and, you know, baseball's a lot about analytics and stats and all that, but it isn't going to be information that makes you an ace pitcher or an outfielder or an infielder. I mean, again, incredible artistry. It's not information. Yeah. Information is going to make you a dud. You're not going to be into the major league. You know, it just isn't, you know, people talk about this all the time. You know, you can overthink your tennis game, you know, and so people then, and they say it in artistry too. You can overthink and it actually becomes creative block. That's what Julia Cameron says on that veranda conversation. Artists, because they haven't done epistemology, tend to think that knowledge is the problem.
Right.
Well, for me, fixing your epistemology will enhance your artistry. The problem isn't knowledge. The problem is a modernist, a skewed modernist, defective presumption about what knowledge is.
Hmm. I wish you were holding a microphone so you could have just dropped it right then. That was really good. That's really, really helpful. No, that's really helpful because I think that for me, that's very clarifying. That's really clarifying. So you talk at one point about there's this great phrase. So Traherne is a favorite, just a favorite of mine, Thomas Traherne, the priest poet. And so this language of kind of creation transfigured and so on is very much Traherne. But so you introduced this idea of the metaphysics of childhood, which also reminds me of Traherne. And it's in a section where I recall you saying that what we have to do is to climb inside the real. Is this kind of what you're talking about when you say wearing our?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Kalani's word, and before we get to metaphysics, still doing epistemology, but Polanyi's word was indwelling. And there's a talk that he got it from John 15.
Interesting.
But you, so, and, you know, let me just drop the word liturgy. The Book of Common Prayer enables you to wear the gospel every Sunday. Like you enact that story, right? Mm-hmm. And then the Lord comes in the story.
Yes.
And the Easter Vigil, you know, but, you know, when I, as a teacher, give a lecture, first of all, I have to wear my lecture, meaning I have to allow people to kind of get inside my body. So they can wear my lecture too.
What can you explain what you mean by that? So they can wear your lecture in.
Yeah, they have to somehow get inside how I'm saying things. And of course, I'm doing this a lot with my hands, you know. But I do a lot of this, you know. But it has to be a hospitable invitation to invite people inside you. So that they can get at what your mind is, the way you're seeing the world. And so actually the job in college is for professors to have allowed students to so get in them that they're wearing them. And for years, for decades, I carried my college notes around in a box. And I never once looked at them. But I have always worn my professor. And so I said to my students, look, you know, you're not going to remember the exact lectures from Byron Curtis or whoever at Geneva College, but you're going to wear him and you're going to remember him. And your job is not to be a parrot, but to let the Byron Curtis bring out the real you. Right. So, but all that's this kind of bodied, indwelt sort of seeing it. But that's what you have to be after. You want to see Jupiter, you have to bend your body down to look through the telescope. You have to get where reality is going to show up. It's a pledge, it's a commitment. That's why I talk about covenant epistemology. You got to promise to love, honor, and obey if you expect reality to self-disclose.
Yeah. Huh. I have to say, so I'm preparing notes on Bernard of Clairvaux and William of Saint-Thierry, and one of the things that stood out to me, because I didn't know a ton about them, but as I was working through some of those things that you find in Bernard, for example, his 4 degrees of love and so on, and William talks in similar ways about this. There is a in both of them, but I'm especially thinking of Bernard. His language is the carnal, but I think he just means the embodied, the situated. That's it's our starting place. And actually, as I was working through, and it's a corollary of the doctrine of the incarnation. This is what's interesting for me, bringing it back to your liturgy comment. That this is something that we rehearse every time we've got a communion service with the comfortable words. There's a logic in the comfortable words. When we hear the word of God to all who truly turn to him, on the other side of the absolution, it comes first through the words of Jesus. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. It's not wrath, judgment, death, hell. It's, in other words, kind of the transcendent. It's the carnally recognized need, you know?
Yeah.
And then in the second one, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, to the end that all that believe in him might not perish but have everlasting life. We go from Jesus' words to the recognition of the Father's readiness to meet that need. And only then do we sort of ascend the spiral staircase, so that we can see our plight from a different, more objective standpoint, right? With 1 Timothy 1:15 saying he's trustworthy, deserving of full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners. There's a new angle on the embodied, on the knowledge that we have that began in that embodied way. And of course, then we end with, was it 1 John 2:1? Sacrifice for our sins, not for us only, but for the sins of the whole world. Anyway, but what strikes me is it seems to cohere so nicely with what you're saying, that that the starting place isn't kind of just any propositional knowledge or even a full propositional framework, but the address, right?
That's a good word, address. Which gets you to the mother smile too, but oh. I want to say something about the word start, because I've spent all this time in the Presbyterian Reformational tradition too.
Yeah,
you know, it sounds spiritual to say you got to start with God, but Polanyi gives us two starts, and D.C. Schindler does too, and so there's a near start and a far start.
Yes, so, go on.
Actually, that plays out in Doorway to Artistry, because I keep talking about it takes the end to give us the beginning. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's the Harry Potter reference and stuff like that. So somehow they're birthed and intertwined together, and it's a near and a far, from to, that's Polanyian language, from to and beyond, right? From relying on clues to shape or focus on and then submit to a farther pattern of the embracing of the real. Here's another book. Sometime in all your spare time, you've got to read this and tell me what you think. It's a hard, it's dense, but it could be a church's philosophy of ministry for a decade. It's by David Kettle. Do you know that name?
I don't know it, but I'm dying to know it.
An Anglican priest somewhere, I think in Australia. And no, and what he was kind of a successor to Leslie Newbegin in the Gospel in Our Culture Network.
Oh, interesting.
So he just totally is carrying on the Newbeginian Polanyian theme. And the book is called, I think, Western Culture in Gospel Context.
Interesting.
And it is unbelievable how he goes to the bank on Polanyi. And he defines the gospel as the hospitable approach of God as our ultimate his word is context, but it's like your ultimate integration, your ultimate word. And then conversion is like this radical attendance. So the gospel breaks in and breaks open. That's his language. And you are caught up in this dynamo of radical attentiveness that effectively is Polanyian subsidiary focal integration at the heart of you know, your conversion. It's this dynamo of openness to the hospitable welcome of God. It's not a book for the faint of heart, but you aren't, so there.
I'm very grateful. I'll look into it with great interest. I love that. I love that language of breaking in and breaking open.
See, the thing is, and you were with your comfortable words, you were saying this too. One of the things that I think is incarnational is honoring the near. Honor, and I think it grows out of a doctrine of creation. I get this from Michael Hanby, who's good friends with David Schindler, you know. But if you want to be true to the doctrine of creation, you got to figure that everything is the yes of God.
Oh, that's good.
And it's the loved yes of God. So you love God, you better love his stuff. And love it on its own terms. Not just for some, how it can hide some secret doorway to God. So I'm trying not to be heretical, but I feel like a lot of Christians, especially in the artistic circles, have a subpar doctrine of creation. And I think the incarnation and, you know, John 1 and, you know, like all of that kind of restores that we ought to be able to love things just because we love God. And we don't love them just because they're somehow, you know, a thin place.
But
just because they're here, right? That's my point about the pedestal dish. It says, here I am. You know, here I am. And that's astounding.
It is.
And intoxicating. Yeah, of course you don't worship the thing. That just turns into idolatry. That's not good treatment of the thing.
Can you say, there was just, it's just a bewitching line about the piece that you're just talking about. The pedestal dish. And yes, there it is. About how you diminish the thing. And I, by the way, I love the Winnie the Pooh-like way in which you capitalize things. I love strategically capitalized nouns. I love it. And
thank you. And Milne is a master of that.
That's goodness. So it's totally parenthetical, totally listeners, sign off for just a second while I explain this, but don't stay with us. Stay with us. We've got a copy of Winnie Ille Pooh, which is, you know, the Latin, Winnie the Pooh. And so there are some choice lines that my children have memorized, but anyway, getting right past that. There is just this wonderful line where you say that we can diminish a thing by making it either less what it is or more than what it is. Tell me about that. That was such a profound.
Yeah, and there's I can't lay my finger right on it. I'm trying to look for the Robert Farrar Capon quote, that his quip about idolatry. That idolatry commits two sins. One is a sin against God, and the other is a sin against the thing. I think is.
Oh wow.
It's in here somewhere, and you know, he's the one that says one real thing is closer to God than all the diagrams of the world, I like diagrams, but I, you know, the primacy of things is what he's saying there. But that, you know, I guess Psalm 73, you know, where the psalmist is in a snit about the bad guys making off so well.
Yeah.
You know, and then eventually it says he comes into the sanctuary of the Lord and perceives their end and da, 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 you know, and it gets straightened out. But somewhere in there, he says something about, I was a beast before you, you know? And so, you know, if you think about the first and second commandments, there's only one being that you can idolize and become more yourself. and that's God. Hmm. So worshiping God makes you more yourself. But if you idolize anything besides God, you become less yourself, which is why you can idolize the pedestal dish. Because, I mean, it's like Capon says, it's an offense to the thing as well as to yourself.
I think that's really helpful. It brings to mind, there's a section of the book you were engaging with Rowan Williams and maybe it was Capon, I can't remember. But you were talking about how things are a thing, capital T thing, is pregnant with more than it is. And it's so good. And
don't you see, that's my old dissertation, Indeterminate Future Manifestations. Things are full of possibilities. So things are pregnant. They're always pregnant. Which means not only our epistemology needs fixed, as we say in Pittsburgh, but our metaphysics does too. So we have imbibed in modernity a denuded reality. And it's not going to help to somehow make it a sacred denuded reality.
Yeah.
We have to get back to reality as it is. And that is real things that are more than they are. As that's Rowan Williams' line. And for me, that's like things are pregnant. They're pregnant with more. Always there's possibilities. And that's why eternity is not going to be boring. I mean, because reality is always unfolding in more.
Yeah.
Everything's a threshold to more. And it becomes more itself. It doesn't mutate. Hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Some alien whatever. It becomes more itself.
So, Esther, how do you think, from the standpoint of artistry, how do you think that impacts the day-to-day work of the poet or the sculptor or a good friend of ours is a carpenter, works on tables and so on. To look into a thing, there's another phrase that sticks in my mind, half-hidden depths, right? How would you kind of describe the way this transformed way of being in the world most concretely impacts artistry? You can change that question any way you like.
It affirms what they can't help but do.
Hmm.
And they're liable to self-describe in a way that hides what they're actually doing. And you know, you think about your carpenter friend. I have a carpenter friend. I remember seeing him hug an oak door he had built. You know, and he was like this big man with muscles, you know, and he was petting his door.
Love it. I love that.
You know, but a carpenter loves the feel and the look of the wood and you know, petting it like, you know, petting it, wanting to feel it.
Hmm.
I could never be a woodworker because it gives me chills. Wood gives me chill. But that's got to be a love. And so I would think that someone who makes is a person who can't help themselves. Hmm. It's like they can't help but play with this magical thing. And so they are kind of like the child, you know, in the metaphysics of childhood, is they're getting reality right and they're getting knowing right.
Hmm.
But modernity has falsified that philosophically, right? So, and they feel like knowledge is a threat to that. So they're liable to say, I don't want to take a philosophy class. You know, I just want to play in my carpentry shop, you know?
Yeah.
But that near tactile love of the wood is the beginning of the possibilities opening to them, right? So yeah. My nephew-in-law Mike, who's a pastor and also is a woodworker, and he and his wife like to, you know, find things in flea markets and then build kind of shabby chic looking cool things. And somebody bestowed on him all the antique siding off of an old barn that was coming down with the stipulation that they that Mike make him a chest. But then he had all this wood left over. It's like 3/4 inch thick hemlock.
Wow.
And he made me two kind of short benches, stools, one for me to put my feet up on and one I use for plants, you know, and for a feature out in my garden. And the one that's out there, he just left the natural curve. Oh my gosh. I mean, it just would break your heart to see it. It's just so beautiful. You could just tell the love that went into his making the plain old stool, you know, and giving it to me. So, and I've got, you know, it's kind of like getting the thickest ever bacon, you know, it's of hemlock, you know, it just makes you really happy.
Oh, I love that. I love the image you keep using throughout the book. I think you've used it a couple times in this conversation. It's just splashing about in the real. And I think one of the pastorally, and I've got an eye on the time. I think we should probably draw to a close here in a moment. But so at one level, pastorally, at another level, just sheer, you know, just as a human, I ache for my friends and for my neighbors who don't have a place in life where they are, or not even just a place, but the freedom to splash about in the real. I long for that for them, and
it begins with acknowledging the real. You know, it's like they've made these things you can put on your face now and have a virtual interaction with virtual reality. I mean, Schindler's point is we have somehow modernity is a conspiracy to protect us from the real. You know, and make things safe. And part of this is that control, mastery and control is endemic to modernity. And if you're going to try to control the real, you are disrespecting it. You know, you are, and that's why for the denuding, you know, you cut it down to ones and zeros that you can manage and scale. It's about power. That's why, you know, it's about power. That's why we've got so many power issues, right? But there's nothing of the kind of surrender and self-gift to the self-giving real that is the essence of knowing. What we were made to be is lovers of the real. We were made for communion with the real. That's what we're made for. And so you got to revamp your metaphysics to go with your epistemology, to go with knowing and being involved with reality being a matter of a dance of communion.
Do you know what you just made me think of? Uncle Andrew in The Magician's Nephew, who for listeners who aren't familiar, C.S. Lewis wrote these great children's books, The Chronicles of Narnia, in one of which, The Magician's Nephew, a scoundrelly character called Uncle Andrew realizes at a moment I won't spoil for you that he could turn a bar of iron into ships if he wanted to and become a baron of industry. And what's so marvelous about this scene is that then there are a whole bunch of talking animals there and they don't know what to do with him. And so they say, because I think he gets knocked out, and they say, well, let's plant him. And one of the other animals says, well, does he go upside down or does he go, you know, which end goes it? And what I think you just made me realize about that scene is the kind of wonderful, exuberant, natural, childlike joy of those animals in a moment where they just go, I don't know what to do with him. He looks like he'd like to be planted. it's such a powerful contrast, I think, from one way of being in the world, which is Uncle Andrew is the incarnation of this kind of pathologically modernistic way of being in the world.
In Doorway to Artistry, I make a pitch for getting back to your natural metaphysics of childhood. Mm. And see, what I realized in writing that book was I wasn't a baby skeptic. I was an adolescent onset skeptic. Hmm. And my babyhood was full of wonder. And so what I'm pitching is everybody's born. Anybody who's born and makes it to adulthood has been rapturously welcomed in the mother's smile, right? And then out of that grows this exuberance about the stuff around you, yeah. Mother and me and near things. Hmm. And it's, you know, it continues to undergird our existence. But we need to get back to it. We need to restore our natural metaphysics of childhood.
Yeah.
We should be astounded by a pedestal dish from Portugal.
Esther, thank you so much. This conversation has been an absolute delight. And the book is, again, genuinely, it's been such a gift. Folks, Esther Lightcap Meek, her most recent book is entitled Doorway to Artistry, Attuning.
That's right.
Yes, and that's what it looks like.
That's my house.
Attuning your philosophy to enhance your creativity. If you are somebody who's engaged in an artistic endeavor of any kind, get a copy. And even, you know, if you're not, you don't have a philosophical background, I think you will be able to navigate and you will find it richly rewarding, especially if you read it with someone else. Esther, thanks so much. This has been a real treat.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Folks, if you've enjoyed this conversation, if you found it challenging, stimulating, helpful, encouraging, please do leave a review wherever you might be listening to this. As always, feel free to write to podcast@ridleyinstitute.com with your ideas, feedback, further questions about things that you've heard. Please do join us again over the course of the spring. I've got a really exciting list of guests: Alex Fogelman, Rosaria Butterfield, Joan Lockwood O'Donovan. I really cannot believe the people who are coming on to chat. So it's going to be great fun. Do join. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Sam Forniker, and this has been the Ridley Institute Podcast.